So how actually we can do that. Then I will tell you a few things that are quite general about time-ordered correlation function versus Whiteman correlation functions, because I think some of this is not completely standard in the literature. And then I will go to the core of our work, which is defining scattering amplitudes in conformal field theory using some version of LSZ reduction formula. And depending on the time that I'll have, I'll talk about an example in phi cube theory and some applications of this formalism. So momentum space, why and how? So the first question is why? Why momentum space? And the main motivation, I would say, is that if you study a conformal field theory in Lorentzian signature, actually, there is, it's not obvious, in a Euclidean CFT, there is one Hamiltonian that is really favored by the symmetry, which is the dilatation. In Lorentzian CFT, actually, you could use, as the preferred Hamiltonian, you can use either dilatation, but you could also use P0 plus K0 over 2 or something like that. They're really equivalent in terms of embedding space. And actually, you see that if I put a scale in there, so this would be P0 plus K0 over R squared, I can as well take the limit R goes to infinity. And then my Hamiltonian is just P0. So that's what I want to argue is that in Lorentzian signature, actually P0 is a very good Hamiltonian to consider. Maybe this is completely trivial to you, but maybe not necessarily. So once P0 is a good Hamiltonian, actually it's very good to organize your state by eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian. So let's work in momentum space. That's just a very general motivation. Another motivation why momentum space is good is that it's very easy to build conformal block. By easy, I mean that if you're given a three-point function, then you get immediately the conformal blocks by multiplying this three-point function. Right? So the conformal block in momentum space are something like, let's say I have scalar operator phi, and an operator O that is some intermediate operator, right? So this is very standard if you want the construction of conformal blocks in this way. But in position space, you have to integrate over the position of this operator O. In momentum space, if you give a definite momentum to these two operator phi, then O must have momentum, the sum of these two momenta, so there is no integration needed. Right, so the difficult thing is to get the three-point function in momentum space, but then constructing the blocks is very easy. Well, in principle, it's very easy, right? So of course, there are some spinor indices in here, and this contraction might be a bit tricky. But, yeah. And finally, the third reason why I want to go to momentum space is that generalized free field theory are trivial. Trivial in the sense that the four-point function are proportional to just some delta function. Say delta of P1 plus P2, delta of P3 plus P4, plus crossing symmetry. Right? While in any other theories, you have one delta function for momentum conservation, but only one, right? In general free field theory, you have two delta functions in there, which means that if you choose your momenta to not be identical 2 by 2, this is just zero. All right. So these are some motivation, but of course, there is a problem. Why do nobody work in momentum space? So the main problem is actually, if we want to do like a bootstrap in momentum space, what kind of correlation function do we use?
Are you going to explain this to
build
the
problem? There are some things that are in some limits that are published. It's not, in general, this is just a heuristic argument to say, okay, there is no integration needed there, right? So you will see, for instance, in our case, how this happened. Because the three-point function are very difficult. The three-point function are not known. Even two-scalar and the traceless symmetric tensor, this three-point function is not completely known. And the other reason, actually, the other reason is that I didn't tell you what kind of ordering of operator I took in there. So this is a very general object. So the problem, the other thing I wanted to say is how, because there is something you need to decide in a Lorentzian CFT. You need to decide if you're using Whiteman functions or if you're using time-ordered function. So you can either use Whiteman functions. So this is really operators acting on the vacuum state. So yeah, I'm not putting the momentum of the operators, but it's just something like this. So Whiteman functions have naturally in momentum space an OPE. There is, if you want, a partial wave expansion, because you can insert a complete set of states in here in the form of a sum over primary operators. But these Whiteman functions are not crossing symmetric. So there is an OPE, if you want, but there is no crossing. The alternative is to look at the time-ordered correlation function. So where now I have a time-ordered product of operators. Now here, this is crossing symmetric, but it's not at all obvious that there is an OPE for this. Actually, there is no OPE. Right? Yes. Well, I think it's not on. But so the question is why is there no crossing symmetry in the one-point function? Because they're analytic continuation of the Euclidean function. So there is crossing symmetry before your Fourier transform, if you want. Once your Fourier transform, the problem is that, well, maybe I can answer this in my next section. I'll show you a Whiteman two-point function and three-point function and show you how this is different from the time-ordered correlation function. So just to remind you, this is nothing special of conformal field theory. The same happens in quantum field theory, in principle, right? You have a quantum field theory of time-order product are crossing symmetric, but there is no unitarity Katz method or something like this for time-order product, right? While they would be for Whiteman function, but Whiteman function are usually not something that is very that's used very much in QFT. So So how is this resolved? Usually, there is a third object that we can consider. It's scattering amplitudes. And what is a scattering amplitude in quantum field theory is you start from the time-ordered product and you apply LSZ reduction, basically, right? So you're looking at the divergence, the poles of this correlation function, and you are getting an object then that has nice unitarity property. Unitarity in the sense that an amplitude is something you can cut and you can write it as a sum of other amplitudes and stuff like that. Right? So this is the idea behind what we want to do. We want to actually start from a time order correlation function in momentum space in a CFT and use some kind of LSZ reduction that is actually gonna pick a piece of this four-point function that is itself a Whiteman function, so for which we can write down a partial wave expansion. Okay, this is just words. This is just the introduction. Now I want to give you some actual equations. And I want to talk to you about, for a moment, about these Whiteman functions. So part two is Whiteman versus time-ordered correlation functions. So I'll just give you the results. So this can be, in position space, the difference between Whiteman function and time-ordered function, if you want, is an I epsilon prescription, how to deal with the operators being at coincident points. So you can just Fourier transform these correlation functions, and you're going to get different results depending on the I epsilon prescription that you started with. And let me just give you what are these 2 and 3 point functions. So the Whiteman let's start maybe with the time-ordered 2-point function of, let's say, a scalar operator. This, there is a delta function that ensures momentum conservation, always. And then, just by scaling, you know that this has to be proportional to the only Lorentz invariant quantity that is in there, to the power delta minus d half, right? And actually, what you get if you do this Fourier transform carefully is you get this p squared minus I epsilon. So this is real if the momentum is a space-like momentum, right? And it has an imaginary part when the momentum is time-like. Okay, so this is very standard. This would be 1 over p squared minus I epsilon in a free theory if you replace this dimension by d half minus 1, right? In a free boson. Now instead, the Whiteman function, the Whiteman 2-point function, so the same thing without the time order product, is a bit of a different object. There is the delta function, still. Then there is still some p squared to the power delta minus d half. But there is a theta function. So this is 0. It only has support in the future light cone. So there is a theta function of p0, so the energy component or the zero component of the momenta. And there is a theta of minus p squared. Right? So this together means this is, it's 1, okay. It's 0 unless p is in the future light cone. Okay? So this Whiteman function has only support in the future light cone of this momentum p. This is what you get by just doing the Fourier transform. So these two objects are not very different from each other. They have different support, but otherwise it looks like something very similar. But now if you go to 3-point functions, things are starting to be a bit different. So let me put the 3-point functions here. So let's stick to scalar operators just for simplicity. Also because it's going to be much more complicated with spinning operator. So I have three distinct operator at three distinct momenta p1 to p3. And if you do the Fourier transform in this case, what you get is this. There is an OP coefficient. Okay, it's not very important here. There is the delta function that ensures momentum conservation. Now there are some theta functions. For instance, I wanted to do something different. I want to start with the Whiteman function, I'm sorry. So let's look at the Whiteman function first. So there are theta functions that say that p3 has to be in the future light cone, and that p1 has to be in the past light cone, or minus p1 has to be in the future light cone. and write it like this, right? So this is only a support when this operator acting on the vacuum as a physical momentum. So if you want the momentum in the future light cone, and this one acting, the conjugate of this one is just implies that P1 has to be in the fast light cone. And then the rest is P1 to some power, which is delta 1 minus d half. There is P2 squared to the power delta 2 minus delta 1 minus delta 3 over 2. P3 squared to the delta 3 minus d half. And then a function of P1 squared over P2 squared, P3 squared over P2 squared. This is just the result of taking the Fourier transform of the Whiteman function, the usual Whiteman function. So what is this function f? It's an Appel F4 function. It's a double hypergeometric. It's a hypergeometric function of two variables. And it has two properties that you need to know. The first is that it's not implemented in Mathematica. And the second property, it's that it's a function that is analytic at 0, 0. And around, actually, around this point, right? So is this a surprise? No, it's not a surprise, actually, because this is really saying that there exists an OPE for this Whiteman function. Right? An OPE means that I should be able to replace this product of operator by some other operator. In that case, it can only be phi 1. And if I do that, I'd get the two-point function of phi 1. So I need to get P1 squared exactly to this power. That is the power of the two-point function, delta 1 minus d half. And then the rest is going to be derivative acting on this operator, which means powers of P1 squared and P1.P2 or P1.P3 squared. So if you want, so this P2 squared, P3 squared times this is an analytic function in P1 squared and P1.P2, for instance, or P1.P3. Right? So this, the form of this function is actually the analytic properties of this Whiteman function are fixed by the existence of an OPE. Okay. I'm sorry?
Who is asking?
So, would you please show the constraint equation for the function f?
What is the equation that this function f satisfies, or?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so it's a system of second order differential equations, basically. You can check if you want. I mean, there is documentation online on this Appel F4 function. It's not something exotic. It's just not in Mathematica, but it's everywhere. So you can find what kind of equation it obeys, and these equations are basically the conformal wired identities of this three-point function, right? So here we are imposed already translation invariance, scale invariance. So basically, but if you work out the conformal wired identities of the special conformal transformation, it's on this three-point function, it's giving you some second-order differential equations whose solution is this Appel F4. In principle, there would be four solutions, but there is only one that has this boundary condition, if you want, right? These analytic, these properties of the three-point function. But again, this is something you can just do by doing the Fourier transform of the three-point function. Now, if you do, I believe that this is nowhere, this doesn't exist in the literature, I believe.
Can we understand that? Let's say we know this three-point collator in the position space. Can we just simply take a Fourier transformation of this three-point collator and then we get this formula?
Yes. So you mean taking the Fourier transform of the ordinary scalar three-point function, right?
Yeah.
It's exactly what you would get. It's difficult to do this Fourier transform, right? You can do it in some limits. For instance, you can do it in the limit p1 squared and p3 squared equals 0. You'll get the leading power in here. It's hard to do the Fourier transform directly, but it can be done. Mostly, if you know what the answer is, it's kind of easy to do it. Now, because then, of course, you know, it's easy to do in one limit, and then you can take derivative with respect to this, and you do the Fourier transform again, and you can really find that it gives you. I mean, these hypergeometric functions are really functions that are nice to expand around the point 0, 0, right? That's what an hypergeometric function is, in a sense, the geometric series. So, once, if I tell you this, you can go and check this Fourier transform, and it will be very easy to check that this is the right thing. Now, I was telling you, this is I think, is not in the literature. What is in the literature is the time-ordered three-point function. And it looks actually quite different. So if I now take the time-order product of these same three operators I had before, then I get something that is quite different. So there is an OPE coefficient. There is a delta function, says the momentum is conserved. And in this case, I will write it, because it's a bit more complicated. Let me write it like this. I will put P2 squared to a power that is the overall scaling dimension of this three-point function. And then times, now the rest, and the rest is x to the delta 1 minus d half, y to the delta 3 minus d half. There is a first function of x and y. There is another piece, delta 1 minus d half, times the second function of x and y. There is a y to the delta 3 minus d half, the third function of x and y. And finally, there is a last, a fourth function of x and y. And x and y in here are this argument of the function I had on the other side. So it's p1 squared over p2 squared and p3 squared over p2 squared. And these f's are again different Apple f4 hypergeometric function. So this is what you find, for instance, in papers by Bazovsky, McFadden, and Skenderis. Claudio Coriano and other people. I mean, I've worked out these time-ordered three-point functions. It's crossing symmetric. It's not at all obvious. I mean, there is obviously a symmetry under the exchange of operator 1 and 3. This was also here, right? Because here is just Hermitian conjugation. But here, there is no symmetry between the exchange on 1 and 2, for instance. Well, here, it's encoded in the transformation properties of these Apple F4 functions. So this is the first message I want to give you today, basically, is that actually, in position space, Whiteman function and time-ordered product are very similar. It's really the same object with different I epsilon prescription. Once you Fourier transform this, it's a very different object, mathematical object, right? No. See, took only 2 days to escalate.
Yeah, I'm confused. So in position space, the difference between the Whiteman and time order is not epsilon prescription. Is that
right?
You have to multiply by some theta functions.
Right. That's right. That's right. Sorry. No, that's right. But you can get what I want to say is that you can get. Okay. But there is some kinematic region where the two coincide, right?
Okay.
You can choose your point that are time ordered, and then the two objects coincide. Here, there is nowhere it's a very different object. It's not only, right, it's for the two-point function, there was a difference in where this function have support, but then also, otherwise it would be nearly the same thing. For a three-point function, though, it's completely different. There is nowhere in the kinematic space where these two objects are actually the same thing. Right?
Can you remind us, is this known that this diamorphic correlation functions can always be Fourier transformed?
It's not known. I don't think it's known. I don't think it's known. It's you can do it for three scalar. You can really do this Fourier transform explicitly. You get this result. You can generalize this. It's been done in the literature for the time order product. Well, in this case, really, we can do the Fourier transform, and you find the result. So I think that's a proof by example.
Isn't it a theorem of quantum field theory that is a temporal distribution?
Yeah, but I don't want to make any statement about that because it would go beyond what I actually know. It's not necessarily obvious for three-point function. Two-point function, yes. Three, I don't know. Yes? I'm sorry? They both satisfy the same differential equation, yes. Yes. So the differential equation that you get from ordered entities are this F4, if you want, hypergeometric equation that have four solutions in general. Here you see all the four solutions, F1, 2, 3, 4. These are the four solutions of the general equation. The Whiteman function is just one of these solutions. The other solutions are actually the shadow transform of the Whiteman function with respect to the operator 1 and 3. If you do a shadow transform of this, you'll get to the other solution. So you can shadow transform this one, or both. So you'll get all four solutions from this. But same thing, this I don't think it's anywhere. I don't think it's in the literature. But it's really, I mean, this just do the Fourier transform and check. It's something that can be done.
So, like in other words, all possible orderings, Fourier transform of all possible orderings can be made from different linear combinations of the
solution. Yeah, I think it's right.
Theorem.
I think it's right. So, why did I want to tell you that? So why did I take half of my time to tell you about Whiteman and time-ordered function? Well, first of all, because exactly this is a bit overlooked in the literature. And second is it's giving us some kind of hint of what we want to do eventually. Because what we would like to do is we would like to take a time-ordered product. So for instance, we can define an amplitude for the three-point function. We want to take this time-ordered product. And we want to do some procedure on it that is going to give us something that has a partial wave expansion. And doing this something is basically clear from this that what we want to do is pick up out of these four terms in the three-point function, we want actually to look at only this first term. Because this is a term that looks like a Whiteman function that has the right analytic properties to have a partial wave expansion. Okay, so this I'll go now to the core of our work. Which is LSZ reduction. So by LSZ reduction I really mean a bit of a modified version of LSZ reduction. So we have a proposal. The proposal is to define a scattering amplitude as the coefficient of this divergence here when p1 squared goes to 0 and p3 squared goes to 0. By divergence, I mean that we are assuming a theory. Let me take the time order product of four identical operators for simplicity, p1 to p4. Okay, so this is a delta function, the sum of the momenta, and then it has some function of the pi. Now this is really a function, right? So this object is distribution in momenta. This is a function. So the The proposal is to define a scattering amplitude as the limit when pi squared go to 0, pi squared minus I epsilon to the power, let me get this right, delta d half minus delta phi of this function f of pi. And I want to work in the case where the scaling dimension of my scalar operator is less than d half. Right? When this is the case, this function f, which is, in the case of a three-point function, would be this thing in the square bracket here. So when delta phi is smaller than d half, this first piece has divergence, power law divergence, in x and y. X and y go to 0 in this limit, and the rest doesn't have such a divergence, right? So what this limit is, I'm going to call this t, an it actually, yeah. Because, well, okay, so what I want to do is actually to be complete. I want, in the case of a four-point function, I want to do this, take this limit for three operators. So in the case of a three-point function, I could define the amplitude by taking this limit for two of the operators. Like I would say, send, for instance, p1 squared and p3 squared to 0. This is x and y goes to 0 and picks this term. I could do it for p1 squared and p2 squared goes to 0. It would pick a different linear combination of this, but which by crossing symmetry is also an apple f4 in another regime, right? So this is not a proof. This is just heuristic idea to say, okay, we have a, in the case of three-point function, it's completely fixed by conformal symmetry. So we know it. We see that it has these divergences, and we can pretend that, okay, let's try to look at something like this. This is really the definition of, I mean, this object IT is what we're going to call the CFT amplitude for a four-point function. And this is what I want to tell you now, I want to tell you why we believe that this limit exists and why actually it gives immediately a partial wave expansion for this amplitude p, right? And
can you say, why is there such a difference from the usual LSZ in which we put all four fields on shell, and here you say, well, we have to do it for three?
We can do it for four.
Why not do it?
We can do it for four. What I want to say is that, so this is one amplitude. I could define a different object that is the limit when the fourth momentum is going to zero of the previous. And this would be, maybe if you want, of t, right? So this is another object I could define. This is more like a scattering amplitude. This would be really now all four external operator. I mean, picking the divergence of all four. Sorry, this is a four external operator. It's in the way I'm going to derive in a minute or sketch the derivation of this LSZ reduction, it's going to be sufficient to do it for three, actually. Because essentially, what you want when you do LSZ is get a piece of the time-ordered correlation function that is dominated by early and late time, operator inserted far in the past and or far in the future. So you want, out of the time-ordered correlator, to get a piece that is basically a Whiteman function, because you can take one operator is always in the past of the others, and so on. So if you do it for three, you're done, because then the time ordered of the last operator is just the last operator. What's the difference is my t here is a function of, if you want, there are six Lorentz invariants in a four-point function, right? I'm sending three of them to zero, so there are three invariants left that I can take to be the Mandelson invariants, so st and u. So this object here is going to be crossing symmetric under S, T, and U here. Now my A is a function only on S and T. So this amplitude is also nice, but is not going to be as useful as this one, right? But if you're bothered by this, think of A at the moment. Right, so I want to take my four-point function and extract the coefficient of this divergence that I claim is there, that is each of the momenta to the power delta minus d half. Right? So maybe I should say it here. I wanted to say it later, but OK. So how do I know in a four-point function? Because the three-point function was fixed by a conformal symmetry. In a four-point function, there is dynamics in there. How do I know that it has actually these divergences, and I can define an amplitude like that? In this case, you can look at the Mellin representation of the four-point function, and it's possible in that case to extract, to show that there is a divergence, and it actually corresponds to the bulk point limit in position space, right? So it corresponds. This divergence is the divergence that is there in each conformal block, ordinary conformal block in position space, when you have z equals z bar between 1 and infinity. There is more or less. Good. Yes? Sorry, no, these have to be primaries. These have to be primaries.
Okay.
These have to be primaries. Very good. Although descendant in momentum space mean multiplying by momenta, so formally, okay. The distinction is not that clear. You have a question as well, yeah.
It is it's also natural to do LSE in coordinate space, right? Is it if I do LSE in coordinate space, mm-hmm. and there it's sort of clear from conformal properties that the limits exist,
right?
And you get this overlap of Lie tree operators with some wave function. Is it the same as this? Or?
I guess it's the same, actually, yes.
Can you show that it's the same?
Not now, but but maybe no, actually, yes. Maybe. Well, so. Yeah, because
so you take an operator and you send it to null infinity in some direction and integrate it with a wave function, which is a plane wave.
That might actually explain the connection with bulk point, but yeah.
I don't know. That's why I'm asking.
So it's an interesting question. It's something we can look into. Good. So I will give you a sketch of the derivation of this LSZ formula. Because the details are a bit complicated, and also what we get at the end is slightly complicated, as you can guess from what is on the far right of this blackboard. Let me give you a sketch. So the idea of LSZ reduction is that, okay, say you have a four-point function, a time-ordered four-point function, in position space now, phi 1 to phi of x 4, and then what I will do is Fourier transform one operator after the other, and take this limit. So I want to do it in the first case, I want to do it for, say, the first operator. So p1 squared, the limit p1 squared goes to 0 of p1 squared to the power d half minus delta phi. And here, the Fourier integral in x1, right? P1, x1. So I want to Fourier transform with point respect to point x1 and take these limits here. So the story is, right, so this is a factor that goes to 0. So any piece that is convergent in this Fourier transform just gives me 0 in this limit. I really need to get to the piece that is divergent. And you can work it out, but actually the only region where you can get a divergence from this is the integral where the time, so the zero component of my position x, of my coordinate x1, is bigger than all the other times. Right? So if I do the integral only in this region, I'll get potentially a divergence. And when this is the case, the time order product tells me that, OK, this operator is further in the future than all the other operators. So I can pull it out of the time order product. So there's a phi of x2 to phi of x4. Right? So I'm jumping over several steps that are not completely trivial in there. But really, the idea is to say, oh, sorry, I should specify that my P1 is a momentum that is in the past light cone. So I want P10 negative and actually P1 squared negative as well. But yeah, just forget about this. So when I take this limit, this piece will be dominated by the late time regions, right? And now once I have this, I can rewrite, if you want, well, I can do this Fourier transform. I could insert in here, in principle, a complete set of momentum eigenstates, where in this case, the only operator that contributes is phi, right? Because this two-point function vanishes otherwise. And well, I can do that. And what I would get, in this case in the limit, is some factor that is sine of pi d half minus delta phi, OK, times something that I will write like this, a state phi of p1, I'm going to define it in a second, times the time order product of the other operator, 2, 3, 4. Okay, and my states, what I call this state phi of p1, is not just the operator inserted. It's not just the Fourier transform of a local operator insertion, but I have included in the definition of this state from factor of p1 squared to the d half minus delta phi. And then, if you want, it's 5p1 acting on the vacuum. Right? I define this state. Why with this factor? Because now it has a nice properties. It has the property that if I take an operator, insert an operator at point x in this state here, I get just e to the ipx. So this is like the scattering state in conformal field theory, right? It's a state that gives me a plane wave when I take the matrix element of an operator at position x. Okay, so the idea is that now this object must be finite. So when I take this limit here, I get a finite object with some prefactor that actually you would be worried that's 1 over sine pi of this, but delta phi is smaller than d half. I chose it to be the case. It's bigger than d half minus 1 by unitarity. So this is just a finite factor. If delta phi would be close to d half minus 1, this would be exactly the ordinary LSZ, right? In quantum field theory, if you want. So, OK, this was not very interesting, not very instructive when you do it for a first operator. But then I can repeat this a second time. And then now there is something very different that is going to happen. So So when I repeat this, so I'm gonna take this object here that I'm gonna call star. And I'm gonna now take a second Fourier transform, another LSZ limit. D half minus phi, Fourier transform with respect to point x2, e to the I p2 dot x2 of this object star. Okay. And again, the story is depending on how I choose my momenta. If I choose p2 also to be like a path directed momentum, this is going to be dominated by the region where the integral, where the operator x2 is actually this one, is actually going to be in the future of x3 and x4. So this is going to be dominated by this object. E to the I, P2, X2. And then I add, sorry, now I have my state phi, P1, the operator phi inserted at point X2, and then the time order product of the operator X3, X4. Okay. And now again, I can. Now this becomes a Whiteman function in terms of this, so I can insert, if you want, this sum of momentum space, momentum eigenstate. And what is going to happen here now is that I'm going to get a Whiteman three-point function. So 5p1, phi inserted at point x2, but I'm going to Fourier transform this, and this operator O. So I can use what I know, what I was showing you before for the Whiteman function. Basically, I know everything in there, right? There is a question.
Yeah, I'm a bit confused. So it seems like you assume that D is larger than 2 when you set the singularity of a block. But on right. The other hand, the bulk point limit is also scattering in D equal 2. So
so far, I haven't used that D is bigger than 2.
Well, the amplitude in two dimensions will be not a function of SMT, right?
Right. So exactly. So, indeed. So eventually, that's true. At the end of the day, I want to go only to d bigger than 2. So why is there also a bulk point limit in d equals 2? I don't know. But no. Because wait, the kind of bulk point singularity in the block.
Yeah.
Right. In this case, there would be only a singularity if D is at least 3, right? Actually.
Right, so yeah, it's not really.
So I'm going to, OK, this is generically defined for D bigger than 2, actually. And now in this derivation, it's true that I should impose also at some point that the momenta P1 and P2 are not collinear. And this can only be true if I have some scattering angle. So I need somewhere in my derivation to be in at least three dimensions. Good. So what do I want to say more about this? Since I'm nearly out of time, not much more. I have 10 minutes, but. Oh, OK. Yeah, but there is lunch, so I don't want to. I don't want to have anyone starving in the audience. So good. The idea is now if I do this with two operators. Okay, let me write what I get here. So what I would get now there is really a sum over all the operators in here, and before only the operator phi would contribute to this sum. Now I really have a three-point function, so I could have any traceless symmetric tensor that enters there, right, in the OPE of two scalars. So there will be a sum over all traceless symmetric tensors, so with scaling dimension delta and spin L. NOP coefficient, 550. I'm getting, out of this procedure, I'm getting a phase, e to the minus I pi half, and the phase is proportional to delta minus L minus 2 delta phi. Delta is the dimension of my operator O, right? Delta phi is the external dimension. There is S, so P1 plus P2, okay, let me write it like this, to the power minus delta phi, minus 2 delta phi, sorry, minus delta. And then I'm getting this three-point function of the operator O that now is a traceless symmetric tensor at momentum P1 plus P2. And the time order product of the last two operators that I haven't Fourier transformed yet. And the last thing that is missing in there is I have uncontracted indices. So there is also a tensor that I can determine from. This is basically a tensor that appears in this Whiteman three-point function of two scalar and one spin L operator. Right? But the important thing in this thing is now I started with my four-point function. I've done this LSZ reduction for two operators, and I've reduced it to a sum over operators times some factors with a phase and a three-point function. And three-point function is completely fixed again by conformal symmetry. So I've got actually a partial wave expansion of my time-ordered four-point function. Right? So I'm skipping over lots of details in there, but that's the spirit. So what is the result of all this? How do I deal actually with this? Actually, it's more convenient now to evaluate this, to actually do it a third time. This is why I wanted to do it for three operators, because if I do a third time, this time with the momentum that is incoming, I can take one of these two operators out of the time order product. I'm getting the Whiteman three-point function in there, and I know exactly what it is. So it's convenient to do LSZ one more. I'm going to spare you that. And I'm just going to give the result, which is actually nearly on the blackboard already. So the result is this, that I get T of S, T, and U, which is this object defined here, right? I want to write it in terms of, I'm going to define m squared to be s plus t plus u, just for notation simplicity, and cosine theta, so scattering angle, that is u minus t over u plus t. So this is something that is between minus 1 and 1, and actually, to be precise, I want to avoid being at zero scattering angle, or pi. So cos theta, I will take it between minus 1 and 1. My m squared, I will take it to be negative, because these are technical choice, but that allows me to make this thing very well defined. And then here I'm getting minus m squared to the power minus delta phi, which is the overall dimension of this t, a sum over all operators that are traceless symmetric tensor. This OP coefficient squared, 550, and then a function that depends only on delta and L, so it's fixed completely by conformal symmetry. And this is S over M squared minus I epsilon and cos theta. And this, if I erase what's not needed, is really the result that we get here. And this function F, right, fixed by conformal symmetry, is this function that I wrote here, which is quite ugly. But OK, if I walk you through, it's not so difficult, right? So there is some powers of this ratio S over M squared, right? So this is some kinematic factor. Then there is some product of some ratios of gamma functions. Some of them are just depending on the external dimension. There is this gamma function in the denominator that has zeros whenever delta has the dimension of a double trace operator. So whenever delta is 2 delta phi plus L plus an even number, there is a zero, which means that if I apply this formula to a generalized free field theory, I get exactly zero for the amplitude. This is why I call this IT, right? Because in a S matrix, in a sense, S is 1 plus IT. The one piece, the forward limit, if you want, is factored out of this definition. So this is all zero in generalized free field theory. And then there is a piece that is a sum of some 3F2 hypergeometric, okay, of the argument, times some Gegenbauer polynomial in cosine theta. Right, so it's polynomial in cosine theta times generalized hypergeometric function in this ratio S over M squared. So this is a bit complicated, but okay, this is you just plug it in Mathematica or whatever, this is a completely well-defined function. So some remarks. Yeah, I told you already that so this F has a zero at double trace operator. Where is it defined? So F, we have defined it actually in a physical scattering configuration. So S is a positive quantity, and M squared is negative. So S over M squared, in the way I define this, is negative. So this is why I added this minus I epsilon in here, because it means that I will get from this first term, I'll get a phase. So in general, T is a complex number. And interestingly, the imaginary part of T, right, so has an additional zero when delta is 2 delta 5 plus 2L. So the imaginary part of T has double zeros at the dimension of double trace operator. So the imaginary part of T is a positive number. Everything else is real positive in there. Well, yeah. Good. So this is a nice property of a scattering amplitude. I derive this at S positive, but I can continue this to a negative S. And then my function F is completely real. And when I'm at negative S, I can go to a regime where S, T, and U are all negative, and there is crossing symmetry there. So in particular, if I take S equal T equal 2 equals minus 1/3 M squared, I'm at a crossing symmetric point. So let me maybe just do a drawing.
Sorry, I don't know. Maybe you explain
a drawing that will tell you where this OPE is convergent and where it's not.
Have you argued already that this sum converges? Or?
Sorry. Oh, yeah.
Did you argue already that the sum converges? Or?
So I didn't argue that the sum converges. There are examples where it's convergent. The derivation actually that went through can be carried at finite epsilon in the I epsilon that I had originally, which can be traced back to the weak rotation from Euclidean space all the way. So in the regime that I was telling you, I think convergence maybe is not proven at the mathematical level of rigor, but I think it's convergent in this regime. So I'm just going to try to draw, because it's a bit of a complicated space, but draw to you which when the OPE converges where. So let me try to do this. So what I want is to draw S in here and T in here. So these are my two axes, S and T. And I will work in unit where M squared is 1. So which means that I can have a U axis that does something like that. S plus T plus U is equal to 1. So this point is 1/3. or minus 1/3. Yes, exactly. This is 0 in S. This is minus 1 in S. This is 0 in T. This is minus 1 in T. And this would be 0 in U and minus 1 in U. So now I want to just remove this piece here, this piece here, and this piece here. So where have I derived this LSG reduction? I've derived it for positive S and T and U between minus 1 and 1. I mean, T and U both negative. So here is the S channel OPE. And I claim that this OPE is convergent in this region of S. What I can do is continue this S channel OPE to S negative, and it's going to be convergent in this region, but not actually this 3F2 as a divergence, or even you can see it even from here, when Z is going to 1. So in this case, when S is minus 1, there would be a divergence. So there is a region of convergent S channel OPE. There is a region of T channel OPE convergent. And there is a region of U channel OPE. And what I claim is there is also this region in the middle. I don't have, oh, do I have colors? Yeah, I have colors. So there is a region here where all three OPEs are convergent. So the claim is that I can define this OPE in the S channel and analytically continue past S equals 0, because nothing weird is happening in there. So I've got, in this case, a region where I have three different convergent OPEs. If instead I had taken this object, so if I send the mass of the fourth operator to 0, P4 squared to 0, this means M squared equals 0. In that case, this region is shrinking, and the three regions of the three OPE, ST and U channel, are disconnected. Right? So this is why I went with this definition that takes only three of the operators to be on shell, if you want. Right? This is a completely fine object. It is a nice relation with the bulk point limit, but it has no region where two OPE converge simultaneously. Good. So now I'm really out of time. And I didn't tell you about the application, so I'm going to skip over the example, but I can tell you a few things, just a few words. Is that this looks like it's a kind of a different playground to do a numerical bootstrap, right? Because you could go now to this point that is a completely crossing symmetric point and look at derivatives of this function in all possible direction and try to get some numerical bootstrap by imposing some bounds. There is a problem. The problem is, in this region, this function here has a single zero at the scaling dimension of double trace operators, which means that asymptotically at large delta, this is something that oscillates, that changes sign. So there is no way of doing a naive bootstrap like that. So maybe there is a more clever way of finding a functional on this that will do something good to this equation. But this is beyond this.
You cannot take the discontinuity.
So the point is, in this region, there is no discontinuity, right? So there is a discontinuity here. So I can take the discontinuity, and then it's perfect. It has double zeros. So that would be a great thing, right? So a function with double zeros at double. Except that now only one OPE channel converges, right? So there is no free lunch, in a sense. It's either you're in this region, everything, you have crossing symmetry, everything converges, or you go to this region where you have this very nice discontinuity, but it's not... there's no crossing. You don't have the crossing OPE is not convergent. The other thing that maybe could be done is, yeah, think of an inversion formula, because that would be maybe something interesting. But this is also just a word. We have not done anything in this direction yet. And finally, this is what I wanted to show you, is that, but I'm out of time, so I'm going to skip this, is that, so this definition of a scattering amplitude is no different than the ordinary scattering amplitude when you're close to a free theory, right? So if you're in a perturbative regime, if you're, say, in pi 4 theory in 4 minus epsilon dimension, and you work in perturbation theory in epsilon, the scaling dimension of your operator, delta phi, is d half minus 1 plus order epsilon, right? So this is just a pole. So this is just, p squared. So this is the ordinary LSZ. So which means that I can take, the example I wanted to show you was phi cube. In this case, the three-level scattering amplitude is just 1 over s plus 1 over t plus 1 over u, right? This would be the ordinary three-level scattering amplitude times g squared, the coupling. In this case, if I don't amputate one of the legs, so if I want to do LSZ only on three of the legs of my amplitude, I get an additional 1 over the mass of the fourth guy, so I get an additional s plus t plus u, right? And then, this is my t in phi cube theory, and I can plug in what I know of the phi cube at the fixed point. I go to the fixed point that is there in 6 plus epsilon dimension. I plug in the anomalous dimension that I know, and I recover exactly this thing from this. And this could go on to several loops order and so on. So for instance, it could be very interesting to look at this in pi 4 in 4 minus epsilon is maybe not that exciting, even though, people have computed crazy number of loops there, so you could use this to extract the CFT data to very large order in epsilon. But maybe in some other CFTs, maybe in n equals 4 or something like this, they could be very interesting to compare the perturbative amplitudes with this object. Good. I think I'll stop here. As you see, this is we have a result. We haven't explored all the application of this yet. So we are very happy to talk with anyone who has ideas or comments about this. Thank you.
Do you have a unitarity, or can you write some versions, some kind of unitarity?
It's not really obvious because the answer is no. In a sense, what I didn't tell you is that so we call this an amplitude, but it's there is no clear way in which this is an overlap of an incoming state and outgoing state, because to use unitarity, you would like to insert some states that are kind of two particle states or something. Use these states again, and this object is not actually an overlap of in and out state. So there is something different in. So it has the properties of an amplitude. It has crossing symmetry. It has this kind of unitarity in the sense of OPE, if you want. But there is no notion of overlap of incoming outgoing two particle state.
Is there some limit where it becomes the overlap?
That's an interesting question.
So how do we measure this function? What would be the experiment to extract it?
That's a very good question. How would you build a detector in a CFT? One very interesting question is how if you deform the CFT, right? If you get to a QFT by deforming this, but I'm really the tools I have been using here were only conformal symmetry. So really, it's essential to this derivation that we are in a CFT. So there actually, yeah, I don't know what is the observable. I don't know. If you want, this is a mathematical object that I can define in the CFT. It looks like it's related to a physical observable in a QFT, but
so just a very naive question. So massless particles sometimes have infrared divergences.
Right.
Do you have anything here about infrared divergences or not, because it's not a gauge theory? I mean,
So I at tree level here, I didn't have infrared divergences. Where this starts to differ from the ordinary amplitude, right, is when I go to next order in epsilon, I would get a log p squared, stuff like this. So all these kind of external leg infrared divergences will be captured by this formula. So this is telling you that not only you take the ordinary amplitude, but you strip off logs associated with external legs. Apart from that, I believe that there should not be any other infrared divergences. This is giving you a prescription in what to do to your amplitude order by order to get rid of the infrared divergence, and the rest should be this T that we computed.
I see. So all the infrared divergence is in this dressing, not being.
It should all be in the dressing. There is no, right. This is looking really at also at a gauge invariant operator. So maybe you have in mind that you could radiate soft photons or whatever. But for gauge invariant operators, I think there should not be additional infrared divergences.
At least in the coordinate space LZ, it's clear that it's more like scattering of jets. It's infrared safe.
Right, okay.
But then also it's clear that you cannot simply apply a symmetric.
That you cannot?
Yeah. Well, there is, it's not like an amplitude. It's
right.
More like an inclusive for a second. So the unitarity is more complicated.
Okay, maybe that's the position space dual.
Unitarity in the CFT is just that it's
lambda
a square of a real number.
Right.
So maybe what Peter was asking, if there was some unitarity as like boundedness of this.
So they could be in a bootstrap way. Yeah, you could get bounds maybe on lambda squared. What I meant is there is no unitarity in the sense of I mean, to bound this, you would need to say, okay, this is smaller, this IT is smaller than I mean, T is smaller than T squared or something like this, right?
Right.
But this is not completely obvious.
This we don't have.
This we don't have, we agree. Yeah?
But I think one way to think about that is that the states, if you think of it as a transition amplitude, the states are not normalizable, so
right. There's
really no... Right. Usually, the transition amplitude tells you that it's a inner product between states, so it's smaller than the norm. But here, the norm is infinite, so there's really no upper bound on T. It's just positivity of the lambda square is unitarity. Mm. I think that's one way of seeing it.
Right. Okay. No more questions. Everybody's hungry.
Let me practice. No. You want?
Can you compute this Fourier transform, say, 2D Ising?
In 3D Ising?
2D.
2D? Yeah. Well, 2D is a problem, as I was telling you.
Well, if you just do the Fourier transform without doing LZ yet.
That's right. Sure. I'm worried that then there could be a problem of OPE convergence, because you were in 2D, you're always in a forward limit, right? Which is exactly where this OPE might be at the border. So I don't know the answer, but there could be a problem like this. You can plug the data of the 3D Ising in there, which is I tried to do it, but okay, maybe we need more operators. But I mean, you don't learn much actually.